Good morning, and welcome to the June 7th meeting of the House Committee on Economic Development and Trade. We have the good fortune today of being able to learn about some really important economic and also safety activity that is underway in the Klamath Falls area of the state. And we are joined by a number of special guests. So I think I will begin by inviting forward Colonel Smith and Colonel Lintag, please. And I will also invite Representative Reschke to say a few introductory words as our colonels are coming forward. Would you like to say some comments of introduction, sir?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sure. When the opportunity was presented to talk about some areas that might economically impact Oregon, I thought of Kingsley and the 142nd, and they're kind of this hidden gem in Klamath Falls, and this hidden gem, you think of Portland Airport, we all think of the commercial side of it, but we rarely think of the military side of it. So these gentlemen will certainly give us a better understanding of what the economic impact is with the F-15s and maybe going forward what that looks like in the next 10 to 15 years. So that was the idea behind this.
That's fantastic. And in addition, if there are things that we could do as a state government that would be supportive of the work that you are doing, that would be fantastic. And also your colleague, would you like to come forward and make remarks also? Because we'd love to have you if you would. Okay, thank you so much. All right, well, welcome. Please begin by stating your name for the record, and we look forward to hearing your presentation.
Well, good morning, Chair Leininger, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Smith. I'm a colonel. I'm the 173rd Fighter Wing Commander down in Klamath Falls.
Chair Leininger, members of the committee, thank you for having me. I am Colonel Christopher Lantain, and I'm from the Portland Air National Guard Base, 142nd Fighter Wing, up in Portland, Oregon.
Thank you both for your service. It looks like you may have a presentation, a PowerPoint for us, but however you want to move forward is great.
Yes, ma'am. We brought pictures of our very cool toys, and we'll tell the story. Thank you, Representative Reschke, for the opportunity to come up and asking the questions. Essentially, as we were approached, we were asked to highlight what our current mission sets are, what we do at the federal level as well as at the state level for our domestic operations and support, and then to basically articulate the economic impact that we bring based on the financial and economic impact statements, and then essentially look at the future based on some recent press releases that we've seen at the national level. There's the brief overview of what we'll discuss. Like I said, lots of pretty pictures of our jets. We just celebrated the 75th anniversary of the Oregon Guard last year in 2016, and so that jet on the left-hand side is the Kingsley Screaming Eagle, which is still painted up, and we'll have it on display here at Century Eagle this summer. And then the bottom right is a alert scramble from Portland a few years ago. So we'll start off with where we are. I'm not trying to insult you. I think you know where we exist and where our units are. But just as an overview, we've clearly got the two, the north end and the south end of the state covered with Klamath Falls down there in the south. We've got Portland up in the north. There's the geographically separated unit, the 116th Air Control Squadron, which is out of Camp Rylea in Astoria. And that's part of the 142nd Fighter Wing. And then we've got the headquarters folks here in Joint Force Headquarters in Salem, Oregon. Also like to highlight where we train. This airspace, this is truly one of the crown jewels for Oregon and for our mission accomplishment. We are very, very blessed to have the amount of airspace that we do, and there's current initiatives to actually expand it. And what you're looking at with this chart is actually showing some of the expansions that are proposed that will help us to continue to meet the current mission set as well as make us even more viable for future mission opportunities. Very few states have this much uncongested airspace that is actually owned by the military organizations within it. So most airspaces across the nation you'll see are highly used by multiple users, multiple services, components, and lots of folks fighting for that time in the airspace. And my active duty time, I remember getting up at literally 3 in the morning for a 4 o'clock jet start to get out there and get my mission done by 5 a.m. because from 4 in the morning until about midnight that night, the airspace was chopped up into 15-minute increments. That's not how it is here in Oregon. We're so lucky to have this. We share the airspace. There's times in the last few weeks where Portland was able to come down and fight against us, which helped us to keep our student training timelines on track. And so we work together and we share this airspace. Clearly, they have airspace that's closer to them and that they use more often, and we've got the southern tier. But when we need to, we share it, and when we have the opportunity to train together, we get to use it together. So I can't overstate how important this airspace is to us and how lucky we are as a state and really as a, you know, the military department to have access to it for our training. The role of the F-15C is simply stated as air superiority. We've been very lucky as a nation since April of 1953. We've not had an American soldier that was killed by the attack of an enemy aircraft. And that's, you know, if you look at the date, 1947 is when we stand up the service. So 6 years later, we've essentially got ourselves mature as a service where we're able to do our jobs. And since then, we've had this condition called air superiority, and we're very, again, lucky to have it. In many cases, I'd say we've almost started to assume it as a nation because for decades we've had air superiority, and we really can't fight without it. It's crucially important to every joint fight that we're in at the national level across the world. There's some quotes out there. General Goldfein's recently stated, talking about that air superiority is not an American birthright, that we need to fight and continue to focus on it and continue to train to achieve it. And then General Holmes, the new commander of ACC, talking about how we've never fought a war and that anybody can even remember at this point that did not involve air superiority. So we believe that we have a very crucial mission and a crucial role at the national level, and we're proud to be part of it. You see that picture at the top right. Everybody remembers that was the year I joined the Air Force and raised my right hand going to the Air Force Academy. 1991 was one of the last big shooting wars, and essentially Iraq buried most of their aircraft. And that's because we had established air superiority and trained so hard to be so dominant in that arena that the enemy didn't even really want to stand up and fight. And so, again, we're proud of our heritage. We're proud of the air superiority at the bottom right. I think the F-15's done an amazing job with it, and it's a crucial part of the air superiority picture. Looking at the overall Air Force force structure, trying to just show you briefly how we fit into the bigger picture, it's kind of mind-boggling to me that in the state of Oregon, you have almost 23% of the nation's F-15 C&D fleet. And you see there the 142nd with its 18 primary aircraft assigned, the 173rd, 26 primary aircraft assigned. Again, we got 53 total in Oregon. You got only 235 across the entire world. So that's pretty amazing that we've got that much capability when it comes to air superiority within the confines of the state of Oregon. Looking at the alert force, I think this is also very telling. What you can't see, because Alaska is always the subset off to the left of a map, is that Portland sits there geographically in a just huge spot for the nation strategically, where you've got them essentially sitting alert 24/7, covering the Pacific Northwest, and they're the first American alert site that is between Anchorage, Alaska, all the way down to Fresno, California. And so it's a critical geographic location. And certainly we've seen the pictures, and we'll have more discussion about the intercepts of the Tu-95 Russian bear bombers that come and fly across the West Coast on occasion. They're performing that mission. We've had a bunch of other scrambles over the years, and it's a crucial role that they fill. There's the other F-15 units and alert detachments across the nation that make up, we typically talk about four corners, but when you add the fifth unit in, we call it five corners, almost like a baseball diamond, with New Orleans down there in the south covering the Gulf of Mexico. Without further ado, Colonel Lantain will talk about more about the mission that the 142nd has.
Good morning again, and thank you for having me. As Colonel Smith had alluded to, Portland is kind of geographically special, or we think so.
Colonel, if you could please restate your name for the record, that would be
sorry.
Great.
Yes, ma'am. Chair Leininger, members of the committee, again, Colonel Chris Lantain, the maintenance group commander up at Portland, Oregon, the 142nd Fighting Wing. So you can see from the slide up there, we have just over 1,300 people, and as Colonel Smith had said, 18 primary aircraft. There's actually 21 jets on base. But we're funded for the 18. Our boss, the Adjutant General, likes to talk about our away games and our home game as far as the missions that we accomplish. In those missions, we have two masters, the state and the governor, and then federally, obviously the Commander-in-Chief directs us federally. The away game, we are a combat-coded organization. We sit 24/7 aerospace control alert. So we have armed jets at Portland International Airport ready to respond to any kind of sovereign airspace infraction. Colonel Smith again alluded to the Bear Bombers. We've seen there was a couple 4th of Julys in a row there where they flew alarmingly close to our borders, and our jets went out and intercepted them and safely escorted them someplace else. So that's one of the that's a home game, but a federal mission, right? Then of course we are destined to go out and do things beyond our borders, and we've seen that recently with Operation Atlantic Resolve. So we did that a few years ago, and we're on tap to go do that in next fiscal year. And basically, what the design behind that is to kind of halt the Russian aggression that's been happening in the Baltic states and in the Eastern European area. So we go and we do some training missions out of Romania was our last location, and just help promote national security objectives there. So there's another great example of our away game for the federal mission. Beyond that, we have a couple special organizations attached to the 142nd Fighting Wing, and one of those is the 125th Special Tactics Squadron. So those are on the ground controllers that embed with special forces teams. Those are the Air Force Special Forces. There's only two in the entire Guard, and Oregon is blessed to have one of them. The other is in Kentucky. We also have the 116th Air Control Squadron. So those are our battle managers, airfield battle managers, and they'll go out with and interact with our pilots and kind of manage the battle space. They set up radars and controllers, and they can kind of they work with our pilots to make their operations more efficient and lethal. When we talk more home game, domestic operations, I think that's a key part of what we do and what we offer for the state of Oregon. When you talk about overall our national preparedness goals, the national response framework, how we integrate with that from planning into protection, mitigation, response, recovery, the full spectrum of what that preparedness goal is, the Oregon Air National Guard is involved in that. And I think you can clearly see that in the Cascadia subduction zone response plan. That's been a fairly hot topic here over recent years. So the Oregon Air Guard was involved deeply in that and will be key contributors if we, heaven forbid, ever have to use that plan, right? We have, in those domestic operations, we have a lot of very specialized tools, and if I could, I'd like to spend some time and talk about a couple of those capabilities and tools. And this will be alphabet soup acronyms, so I'll try to spell all these out for you. If the members of the committee know what these are, please push me along, and I'll jump explaining all of these. But we have a special capability called SURF-P. Any committee members heard of SURF-P? So this is a long one. This is a chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear, high-yield explosive, essentially rapid response force. So what this team will go out and do, if there's a biological scare through a leak at a company, a terrorist attack, this team has the equipment and the training to go out, identify, detect what's there. They can then advise the incident commander, whoever that is, set up through the NIMS system, advise what we should do. They also then have the capability to, in a mass lineup, decontaminate the folks that are exposed to whatever agent's there, and then some sort of triage-type treatment, and then that allows them to be decontaminated, partially treated, and then moved on to a true medical facility. So that is really specialized, and again, hopefully we never have to use that capability, but that certainly would serve the state of Oregon in an attack like that. A couple other really interesting things are something we call the JISC. So that's a Joint Incident Site Command capability. Basically, it's a tractor-trailer truck packed with all the comm needs you could ever use. And they go up and they set this up, and you have many different means of communication, whether it's satellite, voice over IP, radio, telephone. This sets up instantaneous communication capabilities. And I believe we actually used that a few years ago in the make sure I got my terms right, the Grizzly area fire, the Grizzly district. So we deployed that in the state here. Of course, our EOD and our explosive ordnance disposal team and our fire department are constantly called out into the local community to respond there. So a lot of connection with our communities across the state, and we're very proud of that. We'll go to the next one, Sarah, please. So our economic impact to the state, you can read the slides there, but basically it's $89 million impact per year into the state, and that's through mainly the top three up there: payroll, operations and maintenance, and then indirect jobs earned. With a cost to the state last fiscal year, these are fiscal year 16 numbers, of almost $650,000. I can get into any details you want there, but the cost on return based on the capabilities I believe that we offer the state and the communities are well worth it, in my humble opinion.
Please. Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning, gentlemen. Colonel, you're talking here about the economic impact annually, and I'm wondering how that changes when you are deployed.
There is probably some subset of a reduction there because our folks are gone. They change again because we have two masters, state and federal. A lot of our employees are federal technicians, so their pay changes to a true military status. So as opposed to being like an IRS, I liken them to IRS employees or a postal worker, you're a federal technician Monday through Friday, but then when the country needs you, we're called off and put on military orders. So there is some subset of that, but we deploy every year. We're gone every year. I believe, to put it in layman's term, the sausage making here that goes with these numbers, it accounts for that annually. So you would see more of an even baseline year to year as those deployments occur.
I am curious about the $647,000. What is that? What is the state paying or expending in some way to make up $647,000?
Yes, ma'am. Great question. So Portland, we have a couple additive fees than I think you'll see from when Colonel Smith briefs down south. But basically, we have Appendix 22 environmental costs that come with that bill. Roughly, again, fiscal year 16 numbers here, $20,000, just over $20,000 there. And that's a 20% to 80% state and federal split. So the federal government would cover 80% of the total cost, with the state picking up 20%, which equated to $20,000. We also have facility operations and maintenance bills. Again, Portland tends to be a little bit more expensive due to our location than our brethren in the south, and that was just over $500,000 for that. Beyond that, we have the added space of Camp Rylea on the coast, and that's where the 116th Air Control Squadron was at. So we cover some of the operations and maintenance costs for them under the Portland tab, if you will.
So may I jump in then? So the state of Oregon is expending some money? I didn't really track that.
Yes, ma'am.
I think that what you do is really incredibly important. I'm just trying to, and I feel like it's a great value to us, but I'm just trying to understand. So what things is the state spending money to do? Could you use different words to describe it? Because I didn't really get that from what you were saying.
Yes, ma'am. So for the environmental part, we have some.
I got the environmental part, but for the half million.
Our facility maintenance,
So the state of Oregon maintains the facility?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, okay. And some kind of in-kind operation, or we pay to have it maintained?
True. We have state employees, and they go out and they maintain the grounds and the buildings and the facilities that, again, on Portland and out of Camp Rylea.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Does anyone have any follow-up on that? Or that was really helpful. Thanks.
Actually, I do.
Yes, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am aware that the fire facilities have received $1 million allocation from the state in the past, and there's a request in that hasn't been funded in any of the preliminary budgets. But is that something you could speak to or describe to us? So,
I can do my best job, Representative Marsh. Uh-huh. As I'm learning, I'm kind of changing roles here from the maintenance group commander into what we call mission support. So that would include the fire department. And as I transition into that role, I'm learning a little bit about our fire departments. From my understanding, every fire department, the two that we mm-hmm. are concerned with, there are their own unions, and they negotiate separately for their contracts. So they have a separate contract and a separate union. Now, management and labor, we negotiate together, and we're negotiating essentially federal and state monies.
Mm-hmm.
There's a federal cap on what the federal government will pay the fire departments, and again, with the state and the union, we negotiate on behalf both federally and for the governor. If we exceed what the federal government is willing to pay, then the state makes up the difference, and that's where we get the cost of the state and the fire department, and as one of the line items of the 647 for us.
Great. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Did that answer your question? No.
It put some parameters around it. Yeah.
As far as the total bill, I can't answer that. Whether it's $1 million for the state, I know for Portland we are expending $33,000 to pay again in FY16 for our fire department out of state funds.
Excellent. Thank you.
And Chair Leininger, Representative Marsh, if I may, the 1 million number, I can't speak to all the details either, but I know that the 1 million number, I believe, rolls all the federal money into it as well. And I asked that question this morning just to make sure that my numbers were correct, that when we get to the Kingsley side, we're talking $45,000 per year or $90,000 over the biennium for the state payroll, as well as certain certifications for our firefighters, the EMT certifications. Mm-hmm. And that is above and beyond what the federal cap has for us. And so we're 45 a year. There, Portland's roughly 33 a year and over the biennium. So do the math in public, always dangerous. 78 times two. So we're about, $150,000 in a biennium from the state side for probably the $850 to $900 matching from the federal side for the fire departments.
Thank you. Great. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
We got to the fire department fee, so thank you, Representative. The last part that is, again, different from Portland to Klamath Falls is our stormwater fees. So last year we paid almost $15,000 in stormwater fees. That will change this next fiscal year, and that will increase quite a bit, to be honest, of what was negotiated.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Okay. Chair Leininger, members of the committee, Colonel Jeff Smith, the 173rd Fighter Wing Commander. I'm going to shift gears and talk about the Southern Tier a little bit and kind of go over in concert what my counterpart talked about, talking about the home game and the away game in that context. When we talk about the in-garrison mission, what we do at home, we are the sole training unit for all of America's F-15 C&D pilots, whether they're guard, active, or other. So we're proud to have that role. We are the second largest F-15 C&D unit on the planet, only second to Kadena Air Base in Okinawa, Japan. Yeah. We have the second largest active association in Air Education Training Command, with about 90 active duty airmen and their families that got added into the wing in the last couple years, which basically they plug in alongside us, and that helped us to increase our mission set as our guard, man, manpower and infrastructure. The manpower stayed constant. The infrastructure grew a bit to absorb these extra people, but this extra manpower got added in so that we could increase our student throughput to help stem off the fighter pilot crisis that we have in the United States right now, as the airlines are hiring at very fast rates. That's the biggest ticket item. Everybody sees it. You hear it. The F-15s are flying by, and that's what people focus on. But certainly we have other roles going on at home. We've got the 270th Air Traffic Control Squadron, which is a deployable, so away game type of mission. They can go to an austere airfield and a combat zone after our esteemed colleagues in the civil engineering world basically stand up a base. These folks go in and they stand up control so that we can land aircraft in the area. But at home, they essentially man our tower. So the civil airport tower at Klamath Falls is manned by the members of the 270th to help with the civilian air service as well as all the general aviation, along with controlling the F-15s on a daily basis. So adding a lot of value to the community. When we talk about the fire department, we just highlight them. It's amazing what our fire department does. We had about 115 off-base responses last year. Just based on how spread out Klamath Falls is and the rural nature, there's times when Fire District 1 from the local community just can't get there fast enough. And so when the phone rings, our folks go off-base, assuming we have the resources and capacity to do so. And so 115 times they went out last year helping people who were having medical emergencies, putting out structural fires. They responded twice to conflagrations, which is never the easiest word to say. But over the last two or three years, they've been out and about and helped to actually fight the fire that was up by Crater Lake to protect the lodge a couple years ago. So really proud of what those guys and gals do. They also clearly respond to any emergencies we have with the F-15s to keep our pilots safe. And they also have responded to several civil aviation emergencies. We had an Alaska flight divert in there one time for an emergency. Mm-hmm. Typically, you know, somebody has a medical emergency and they drop into the closest airfield, and our folks respond, help basically take the initial steps for care and then transport to the local hospital. So our fire department does a great job. Again, proud of what they do for the local community and how engaged we are. Additionally, when we talk about domestic operations, Chris mentioned it, Colonel Lantain, the Cascadia prep cannot be overstated, I guess. There's so much to do. And it's a difficult to wrap our minds around how big of a problem it would be. And as we start into looking at the scenario and the possible recovery efforts, we see a clear role in this from Klamath Falls to possibly be a logistics hub. We're outside of the worst effects of the possible earthquake. Essentially, we're looking at a magnitude 5, maybe 6 by the current estimates. We'd lose power for a couple days, but right now we're working with at the national level to try and get a solar microgrid established at Klamath Falls on Kingsley Field to help us maintain calm and response capability in the case of something like this. So base resiliency is becoming very important for us so that if this were ever occur, God forbid, that we could essentially shift gears, make sure that we've got at least the minimal lights on so that we can communicate with the national level as well as FEMA and anybody else in the region to say we're okay, here's what our infrastructure looks like. Whenever you need to bring the airlift in to start getting supplies and people here, we're ready. And so we see that as a huge role, and we're exercising our abilities to respond in that capacity. And again, how do you put a value on that? I don't know, but I see a huge need for that if this were to ever occur, so that we could help from that side of the Cascades to actually bring supplies and people to where it's needed on the coast and really west of the I-5 corridor.
You know, I think that's an exciting and a really important sounding function, and I think it would be a good opportunity for that part of Southern Oregon to have some additional strength and economic capacity, economic opportunity. Are there things that the state can do to support expansion of that capacity for the base, or that we can do in terms of advocacy at a federal level to help people see that as an important investment opportunity for the Klamath Falls and Southern Oregon area?
Chair Langer, one clarification. Are you talking about the solar microgrid or the entire response capability?
I guess, both things. It sounds like to the extent we can diversify, we can support diversification and expansion of the capabilities of the Kingsley Field and, associated set up that's good for Southern Oregon and that's good for economic opportunity in the region. And I don't know if there's a role for the state or the legislature to do advocacy or help with that, but I think it would be an intriguing opportunity.
Yes, yes, ma'am. I can tell you that whenever we also have a geothermal opportunity,
right,
that's underway right now.
Right.
They're studying, and we're about to get the results from the preliminary study that will then drive us to either drill a test hole or not based on the results. But right now, everything seems very promising. So when we talk about resiliency and the ability to respond and be there and ready, I think there's a lot of efforts. The microgrid, we're getting support from everybody. When we say it out loud, people start nodding. At the national level, we've got a lot of support from Senator Wyden, Senator Merkley, and Congressman Walden's staffs have all said, yes, let us know if anything gets bogged down, and we're there to help. So we're very supported and feel supported. But on the National Guard side, I can tell you that nobody's saying no either. Everybody's excited by the opportunity. They feel that it's relevant and interesting and necessary, really. There is one way that when we talk about advocacy that could possibly help us. The city of Klamath Falls, through the local airport, is essentially expanding on the east side of the runway. And so they've just put in a Taxiway Bravo project, and right now it's all torn up and they're working it. And when they outlined the design for Taxiway Bravo, they also added in a ramp expansion on the east side that's primarily for the Forest Service. When they show up in the summer to get ready for fire season, to basically go out and put the fire retardant down, that east side gets pretty full. And so they built a ramp to expand that. And when Mr. Barcelou, the airport director, said, hey, we're putting a ramp over there, we started looking at the dimensions of it and said, well, if we could make that a little bit bigger, we believe that would then give us capacity when we're not talking fire season, but we're talking Cascadia. Now we can get additional C-130s or C-17s parked on the east side to load and unload. And there's I have to speak delicately. You know, we are constrained when we go for funding for ramp or infrastructure. We're constrained by our current mission set. In our current mission set, we have enough ramp space. We have enough ramp to house the F-15s. We have enough ramp to hold the general aviation on this airport. It's not in my capacity to really say, well, what if Cascadia happens? Don't we need that extra concrete? That advocacy and or understanding that maybe we do need to spend some minimal investment now for the opportunity to be prepared in a time of need, that might help. And it may be too far gone at this point because the construction's already underway, but that would be one way, ma'am, that I could see an expansion of capacity that would be useful to the state, either in a time of big fire season or in a time of a big state natural disaster.
Well, that's really helpful, and I'm looking at the senator for the district and the representative, and this might present an opportunity for us to follow your lead and support some activity in your districts that would be good for everybody. Thanks.
Yes, ma'am.
Madam Chair.
Please. Thank you.
Can I follow up on that?
Yes, please.
The microgrid is intriguing, and I don't want to put you on the spot, but do you happen to know what the generating capacity will be? What do you figure your overall needs are in
megawatts? Chair Leininger, Representative Helm, I cannot speak to those details. I wish I could. When we've talked theoretically about it, and it's already in design phase, they're looking at what they can power. They're looking at the command building, so that where I work, not because where I work is important, but because the emergency operations center is housed within that building. So that's where we've got our communication systems to be able to reach out to the outside world. So we're looking to put some power capability attached to that building. Building 210, which is their comm hub, that building would be powered under this microgrid concept. And then there's some discussion of, okay, so that's the, we're in a time of crisis when we're using the microgrid. There's some discussion of, well, could we use that power during normal operations to help reduce the power footprint, essentially, of our simulator building. So our simulators are hugely important to our student training, but when you have large avionics, large electronics, you need a lot of cooling, as we know, mm-hmm. and humidity control. And so that's a large power bill on our base that if we could offset that using the microgrid and the solar capacity that we've got in the south with sun 300 days a year, that would be of use. So that's what we're targeting right now because we don't want to start too big. We want to essentially say what are the key nodes that we need and where can we make some offsets in a time of peace right now. And then we'll look at, I think, expansion over time if it's a successful model.
Thank you.
Excellent. Representative Helm is chair of the Energy Environment Committee, so he has a lot of good insights into that arena.
Okay.
All right, great. Please proceed if you have more.
Okay.
Yeah, sure.
Ma'am. There's one other thing that I'd like to highlight. The Portland unit is a combat deployable unit, and most of our folks we have an in-garrison mission of training students at home. But right now, we do have the largest deployment we've had in a long time underway. So we've got about 50 airmen overseas, and they're starting to trickle back and come back, and they'll be coming back all through the summer as we welcome especially our security forces back to their families, as well as some of our other members in Agile Combat Support is what we call it. So we do have that deployment role as well. I think it was Representative Gumberg that asked about the impact to the pay or impact to our economic impact when we have folks deployed. Mm-hmm. I can tell you we're supposed to know every detail about our wings, and I try to dig in. The other day I was looking at our full-time manning, and I was surprised at the numbers that I saw. And when I dug into the details, what I was seeing was the addition of the backfill, the people that when we send members deployed, that we bring a lot of our part-timers. Either our part-timers get called up and they deploy, and so our full-timers are still at home doing the mission. And especially with Portland, you think the 24/7 alert, that is always there and always happening. At Kingsley, when we send 50 members downrange, what happens is either the part-timers go downrange or our full-timers go and the part-timers come in. And so you still have that full-time presence. It almost looks the same when you talk about a manpower footprint because our in-garrison mission has to continue. So I don't see, at least on the southern tier, a large impact. And in some ways, there might be positive economic impact when we had deployment because there's more full-time people, even if some of them are overseas at the moment, spending their money overseas, while their families are still at home receiving that paycheck and sharing that in the community. So we're proud of our folks that are deployed right now, and we look forward to getting them all home safely this summer. As we get to the next slide, very similar to what you saw from Colonel Lantain up north, here's essentially our big ticket items are the same. It's the payroll, $56 million, and essentially $81 million per year into the Oregon economy, which is a huge deal, especially in the South, where, again, it's rural, as we've mentioned. Mm-hmm. We're the third largest employer in the area behind the local hospital with Sky Lakes, as well as Geldwin, which still has a large footprint down south. And so because of that, I think because we're such a big player in the economy, we are very well connected. The community support we have from our civil leadership and basically the local colleges, it's just phenomenal. We have a great working relationship with them, and we are constantly looking for synergies and ways we can work together and make things even better for the Klamath Basin. Any questions on the details of this? Okay. Okay, so we've talked a lot about local mission and what we do here in Oregon. This is the transition, as Representative Reschke highlighted to me, that there's been a fair amount of press about possibly the F-15 could retire, and that is not at all decided, but they're looking at it. And we're going to talk a little bit about why that is based on what we've seen. This is an image depicting the fourth-generation fleet that we've got in the United States right now. You can see that we have the average age of our fleet is 27 years old, so across the Air Force, including our heavy aircraft as well. The Secretary of the Air Force and the Chief of Staff of the Air Force have highlighted a huge bow wave in the next 10 years of modernization requirements. And so that's put us in a spot where we have very difficult choices ahead as a nation, where as we try to manage capacity, meaning just raw numbers versus capability of how many fifth generation and beyond type of fighters do we need and capabilities do we need, there's a balance in the budgeting act as everybody has. You have to work on the priorities, you have to figure out what your risks are, and then make decisions based on that. As I alluded to when I raised my right hand, Desert Storm had just occurred, so 1991. Back then, we had 134 fighter squadrons in the United States inventory, and now we're down to 55. And yet, we've been in combat for the last 26 years without a break. And so, as we've continued to get busier and busier, the airplanes get beat up as they get older and older, and we're using them all the time for combat. At the same time, we're drawing down and getting smaller, and that's the challenge you hear at the national level all the time. So that sounds like a very dire and negative message if I'm going to talk. But it's truly, at this point, it's just a reality, and I think it's something that everybody's looking at. What do we do for the future? What is the right mix as we move forward? And that's where the analysis is going. At the bottom, you see all of the recapitalization and modernization projects that are essentially happening in the Air Force, whether it's F-35, B-21, KC-46, the new trainer that replaced the T-38, the T-X, the OAX that will eventually replace the A-10, although the recent news shows that the A-10 has been funded for sustainment and is basically being extended for the next 5 to 10 years at a minimum. And we're also looking at aging space, nuclear, and certainly now an evolving cyber presence and need, both on the defensive and offensive side of the house. So a huge amount of investment as the world changes and continues to be a volatile place. And there's a lot of priority analysis going on at the highest levels to try and figure out where we go from this. So that brings us to the F-15. It's an amazing platform. It's been amazing. Designed in the late 60s, fielded in the early 70s. It's just unreal what it's done. 104-0 for its kill ratio and still going, essentially. The average age of the fleet's 35 years old. At Kingsley, they're 37 years old. And so that's mind-boggling to me when you think about a 9G fighter. It's not an airliner. You know, our tankers are built in the 50s, which isn't great when we talk modernization. We need to modernize. But it's you can stomach it because it's a 2G airplane as opposed to a 9G fighter that's still going after 37 years. So, again, it's amazing where we've been, and you can see that even in presidential budget 18, there's still investments going on into the F-15, both on the modernization side with new electronically scanned array radars and on the sustainment side with the SLEP is what it's called. It's a service life extension program. And so there's investment continuing as I think the folks at the national level continue to look at all the options and what's the right mix for the force structure. They're also recognizing that we can't bypass the modernization needs that we have right now, because until we make the decision, we need to make sure that this airplane is still ready to go and ready to fight if the nation needs us tomorrow. So this slide basically says there's a ton of unknowns. So when Representative Reschke asks, you know, and I say, I don't know, sir. I don't know what the future holds. The national defense strategy kind of gets laid out. Then they look at what the force structure should be to match that threat and that strategy. That's when they'll make those decisions. But certainly we can acknowledge that in the news they've said that F-15 is one of the ones they're looking at to figure out where we go next and how we get through this. I think based on everything you've heard us talk about today, if there's any...
Please finish that thought, and then I'm going to invite Representative Reschke to make a comment.
Just going to say, I think if there is good news here, and I think the good news is if the decision is made to keep the F-15 through 2030 or 2040, then folks are already recognizing that the investments need to be made on the sustainment and modernization side. And if that's the case, you've got stability in the north with Portland, you've got stability in the south with Kingsley for years to come. We're asked continually to grow more. We're being asked in the south to produce more pilots right now to try and get through this bow wave of a fighter pilot crisis. And so that growing mission in this airplane is still a success story, and we're optimistic. If the F-15 retirement comes to play, if somebody decides that that's the right path for the United States, we also feel that the state is still in a solid position. The nation cannot stomach, at least through the CSAF and what he wants to do. We can't stomach getting smaller than 55 fighter squadrons. And when you have fighter culture already established, you have fighter infrastructure, you have alert barns that are already ready, you have people that understand that mission, both on the maintenance side as well as the pilot side, you've got a culture. And you don't just grow that culture out of nothing. You can't just stand up that fighter squadron in the middle of nowhere tomorrow and expect it to succeed. And so one of our biggest strengths right now is years and years of expertise, excellence in our mission accomplishment, and just quality folks that are doing amazing things every day. That is probably one of our biggest strengths to say, if these fighters are retired, that the units are both in a good position to likely convert to another fighter, because we need those fighter units for the raw capacity and capability standpoint.
Thank you. Great point. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. He just answered my question. So, is about the transition. What would be the advantages to keeping Kingsley where it's at and the 142nd where it's at if you're to transition to an F-16 or F-22 or F-35? And I'm assuming the F-35 would be the better choice, or you wouldn't be making that, obviously, but it'd be a better fit, I guess, would be a way to say it.
Chair Langer, Representative Reschke, you're right. I would not get to make that decision. The F-22 is an amazing platform. We've got great airspace for air superiority training. The only thing I can say about you've got one platform that's growing. So the F-35 is continuing to come off the assembly line. They're continuing to grow the capacity across the nation, which means they will have an increased training need at some point. And so we're a training base. That would be a logical fit for a straight conversion. An F-22 conversion is certainly viable as well, or an F-16. The only interesting part of that is it would require likely a double conversion. So you've got F-22 training occurring at Tyndall Air Force Base in Florida. If they were to transition to some other mission, so that we would take on the F-22 training, then they were converting and they're converting, which requires infrastructure investment, personnel changes, equipment changes, and it takes time to do that. So from a strategic level, I would say that that would be one of the risks that folks want to avoid, is that double conversion. Although, if that's what the decision is at the national level, we are prepared for and are able to accept a double conversion or any conversion. And again, I think it's a positive statement that we are in a position of strength where we're doing so well that we are both needed, our mission sets are needed, that regardless of what type of airplane it is, it's very likely it's going to be another fighter, because the nation needs fighter units and they need that fighter culture, and we've got that established.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you. So does that conclude your presentation, or were you going to continue?
We're awful close,
Mike. Oh, okay.
Let's see. I think we can wrap it up very briefly with our strengths and then hand it over to you for questions.
Thank you.
Sure. Thank you again, Chair Leininger. I'll just expand just briefly here on specific strengths for the Portland Air National Guard Base, a little bit beyond what Colonel Smith just talked about as far as our viability to continue into the future, no matter what that is. So the old adage, location, location, location. Location gives us great strengths up in Portland. So namely, we talked about the five corners between Anchorage and Fresno. There's 2,000-plus miles. If we were not there, it'd be awful hard for one of those areas to intercept, and kind of that sweet spot right in the middle. So we continue to provide sovereign airspace protection for the country from Portland. We talked about the airspace. Again, that just close airspace for our pilots to train in just offers efficient, effective use of our time and money. So that's it, as Colonel Smith said, a crown jewel for us. Location, again, because of the Portland-Vancouver metropolitan area, we enjoy very great recruiting numbers. When you look at Oregon from a national perspective, we are recruited to our full-time strength pretty darn well comparatively to other states. So when we talk about capability expansion, future missions, the National Guard Bureau and the Air Force leadership look to states with great manning. We've proven we can support whatever they would like to send our way with manning. So we enjoy our community aspect, and we have a large community in Portland to draw from. And then lastly, I've got a picture of the Portland International Guard Base up there. We are a fighter base. We have a lot of infrastructure to support the F-15s. All that is convertible to a bridge mission in an F-16. We could accept F-35s. We meet all the criteria for F-35s, and we are on a list to be considered for F-35s with other guard bases across the country. And that just talks about the fighter, which is the big mission set that we have, but I've also alluded to the Special Tactics Squadron. We have a tenant unit, a reserve tenant unit, and they're a rescue squadron. So there's some desire or belief that we could create some sort of special tactics center of excellence there in Portland. And certainly our special operations forces are in high demand, and they've been in high demand for quite a bit of time. So that is another mission growth area that we believe we could support at Portland.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Leininger, members of the committee, focusing on the southern tier, I think our strengths, we've got an uncongested airport, so being in the middle of, not in the middle of nowhere, but in a rural community, it's very helpful when you're training F-15 pilots. And so as we are training pilots, we don't have congestion at the airport, and that makes it very useful for us teaching our folks how to land and take off. When we look at the flying weather on a couple of those slides, again, 300 days of just beautiful weather. We're in the high desert, very much like a lot of the other training units that live down there in Arizona, where the desert environment's great for the airplanes and great for the flying. Our public support in the lower left, that's Century Eagle. That's another economic development or economic impact when we bring about 10,000 folks through our gates for an open house. And we're doing that this summer on July 22nd. I'd love for you all to come down and see it. But that shows truly how much the community does embrace us and embraces what we do. When those folks come out and shake our hands, it's a special event. And our community relations with the local government and civic leaders is just unprecedented. It's unrivaled. It's phenomenal. We've got over 200 tanker opportunities a year. We're surrounded by tanker units across the Pacific Northwest. and we've talked about the airspace enough. We've got great people just doing great things, and I think, again, with that fighter culture that we have, we're in a great spot. So we're there. We think we're value-added for Oregon. We bring a lot of capability on the domestic operations, and we're constantly looking at those options while we're still focused on we're still accomplishing our federal mission and doing it with style. And I think the National Guard motto that's been at the bottom of all these slides of always ready, always there, we're there, and we're there every day, and you've got your 24/7 alert up north. We're in for the state of Oregon, and we're here to serve as the nation needs us with respect to future mission. So we'll field any questions you have at this point.
Excellent. Thank you. Any additional thoughts or questions for our panelists today? Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Chair Leininger. Is it unusual to have, or is it special to have a training base so close to an active duty base or an alert base, in the sense that you have Kingsley and you have the 142nd? Obviously, there's the other four corners, but for other aircraft, are training bases normally that close, or are they usually spread out farther, or how unusual does it happen in the same state, I guess?
Chair Leininger, Representative Reschke, I think it's unique. You won't find many other guard units that have two fighter units in the same state. In many cases, they wouldn't have the same fighter. How we got here is a long story. But the reality is most states do have an active duty presence, and the state of Oregon only has the Guard. And so I think this is your military presence. It happens to be that the nation needed their training for the F-15. They needed more capacity back in the day when Tyndall Air Force Base was doing F-15 training. They needed more, so they asked Kingsley to take that on because we were in a great training location for all the reasons we've already discussed. And so as you hit those highlights, you go, well, they saw a need and they shifted it over. And then eventually, as the F-15 fleet drew down, they converted that base at Tyndall into F-22. At the same time, they need air superiority on the corners because that's a mission set. That is a strategic part of the defense of the United States. And so the right platform for that mission was the F-15. And so that's essentially how we got here. And, some folks... I basically see it still as a position of strength, not because it's the same fighter in the same state, but because the need was there, and they recognized that both of our locations were uniquely suited and kind of perfect for what they needed. So we're executing what they asked us to do. They just happened to put the same type of fighter in the same state.
I'm glad they're both in Oregon.
That's right. That's for sure. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Coach Harris. And again, thank you, Colonels, for being here today. I wanted to talk about the earthquake. With two of your facilities being in the potential impact zone, if you could just give me maybe 1 minute on what your resilience plan is and also what services you'll be available to provide to the rest of Oregon in the aftermath of a major event.
Chair Leininger, Representative Gomberg, as I kind of alluded to when I talked from the perspective of the 142nd Fighter Wing, we have been involved since the inception of the what we call the Cascadia playbook from an Oregon military department. Not just, I don't want to sell short our Army brothers and sisters. So the entire state's military department has been involved in Cascadia. Portland will be affected. It will be drastically affected. The models that I've seen, it would be anywhere from a 7 to an 8 on the Richter scale. You know, the coast would obviously have the 9 and 9-plus earthquake. So there will be drastic effects to our infrastructure. They anticipate PDX will be unusable. That's why we look to our brothers and sisters in the south for a great launching-off point for helicopters, for C-130s. Whatever we needed. Once our members know their families are fine, we have a plan to get our folks back in, and we would essentially follow play by play with the Cascadia playbook in our response efforts. I alluded to just a couple of the big capabilities we have, but logistics become a massive problem in this scenario. But we have heavy equipment. We have. We have medical technicians. We have fatality. Unfortunately, in this situation, again, we'll have thousands upon thousands of fatalities. So we have a fatality search and recovery team that can go out. We have security forces that can provide point defense or protection of mass care facilities. We have the ability to set up mass care facilities with some of our equipment, tents, beds, cots, that kind of stuff. Beyond the specialized stuff, we have, as I said, 1,300 folks in our wing and almost that many down south. So over 2,000 men and women that will be out there in the communities wearing the uniform and be able to respond to help save lives and recover.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Representative Brocksmith.
Thank you. Thank you, Colonels, for being here. And part of that coastal resilience, where does the Cape Blanco Airport, which is in my district, lay in your emergency preparedness play handbook?
No, sir, I can't answer the specifics on that one either. Are you asking with respect to when we would respond or how we would respond? Or would we be able to use it?
Yeah, well, correct. So it's been identified as one of the only coastal airports that will survive. It has the ability to handle over 100,000, I think it's 100,000 tons. So it can handle the fully loaded C-130. It's really a modern marvel, right? Built by the Army Corps. It's an inch taller on one end than the other. It's built on solid bedrock. So all of the boxes have been checked that will, the Cape Blanco Airport, although the folks on the Southern Oregon coast, there's not a lot of population, but strategically, it will be a important tool for recovery, moving heavy equipment around, and so on and so forth. So I just didn't know.
We would, I'm sure, use, again, our Army counterparts with their helicopters. So I foresee, as you alluded to, a dropping off point of thousands and thousands of pounds of supplies and medical supplies, food, water. And then I think what the plan calls for is you find those little spoken hubs, you deliver the supplies to an area like that, and then the helicopters pick it up and get it into areas where you just cannot reach with any kind of vehicle other than through the air.
Yes, sir. If nothing else, we'll make sure that we'll take a note and make sure that we highlight that to the Joint Operations Center, which I'm sure has it in the plan. I just can't speak to the details of the plan today, but we'll follow up and make sure that we've got a plan and that it's on our map so that we're integrating that into our thoughts and plans.
Very much appreciated.
Yes, sir.
Excellent. All right. Well, thank you so much. I think this has been really helpful, both in terms of helping us know the great work that you do, identifying potentially ways that we can support your great work. And then third, I would say, you know, as our society has moved past mandatory service by decades and decades, you know, in states like Oregon, where we don't have a tremendously large military service community, there can be segregation or people just not knowing about the good work and having relationships with the good people who are doing the work that you do. And I think it would be to the benefit of our state going forward to have as much interaction between people who are in the armed forces, in military service, and people in civilian leadership roles, or just, you know, folks who have not had the good fortune of the training that you have, continuing to build relationships and understanding and goodwill, because heaven forbid we fail to have that and aren't available to mutually support one another at the times when that's important. So thank you for being here, and I believe perhaps you are going off to a new assignment or a temporary assignment. Someone here might be doing something like that.
I'm changing roles. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. Well, congratulations. I hope you have a good hot summer. Timing wise, I suppose that's right. A mixed blessing, but I hope it's wonderful. Thank you for being here today, and you can go ahead and have a seat. And I want to say to the committee, folks, this is going to be our last meeting for the session. We're going to have interim days, so if we have additional topics to explore, we can do those during interim legislative days, which are quarterly, and we will get in touch with you about an end of session gathering that we can do sometime in the next 2 weeks. But for now, it's been a real honor to do this work together. I think we've gotten some good things done, and I look forward to more productive teamwork in the future.
Thank you, Chair.
And the meeting is adjourned.
Thank you, Chair.
And the meeting is adjourned.